Welcome to today's program titled 2015 National Year in Review. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen, then type and send your question that way. This presentation has been prepared by Seyfarth Shaw, LLP, for informational purposes only and is not legal advice. This information is not intended to create, and receipt of it does not constitute an attorney-client relationship. Participants should not act upon this information without seeking professional counsel. The material discussed during this webinar should not be construed as legal advice or a legal opinion on any specific facts or circumstances. The content is intended for general information purposes only, and you are urged to consult a lawyer concerning your own situation and any specific legal questions you may have. Any tax information or written tax advice contained herein, including any attachments, is not intended to be and cannot be used by any taxpayer for the purpose of avoiding tax penalties that may be imposed on the taxpayer. For those interested in obtaining CLE credit for this webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation that will be required on the CLE attendance affirmation form. Please write this code down. It will not be reread, and it is required for CLE credit. Copies of the webinar recording and PowerPoint presentation will be distributed to attendees in the days following the webinar. At this time, I would like to turn it over to Robert Milligan to begin.
Thank you, and I'd like to welcome our guests for joining us for today's webinar. In today's webinar, what we hope to cover is to provide a national year in review of the most significant trade secret, non-compete, computer fraud cases and trends that we've seen over the past year. We have an ambitious agenda. I'm joined by my partner, Jesse Coleman, who's a partner in our Houston office. Jesse specializes in non-compete, trade secret, and business litigation. I'm also joined by Joshua Salinas, who's a managing associate in our Los Angeles office, who also specializes in business litigation, as well as trade secret and non-compete litigation and counseling. My name is Robert Milligan. I'm the co-chair of our national trade secret, non-compete, and computer fraud practice. I'm based out of Los Angeles, California. Again, thank you for joining us. We want to make this very useful use of your time. Feel free to ask any questions through our online menu, and we'll hope to answer those questions at the end of the program or through a follow-up correspondence. Brief overview of today's agenda. We're going to go over some of the noteworthy data breaches and criminal prosecutions and sentences for trade secret misappropriation, data theft, and computer fraud in the past year, and a brief discussion of some of the lessons learned. I think that's always a good way of looking at, you know, what went wrong or what went right on some of these noteworthy cases, so that companies can learn, you know, either not to be them or to be them, depending upon, you know, the circumstances. Joshua is going to cover some of the new trade secret cases that have come out within the last year, focusing primarily on damages and injunctive relief, which are often the two key things that plaintiffs are seeking to obtain in trade secret cases. Now, this past year, there was a number of states that passed new restrictive covenant legislation. We had states Alabama, as well as Oregon and Hawaii, who passed some new non-compete legislation. We're going to go over some of the rules of the road as it relates to that new legislation. We're going to highlight, you know, the growing circuit split concerning the applicability of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. Those that are familiar with that act, it's a federal statute that provides a civil remedy and that also criminalizes computer hacking. It's been used by some employers in your typical employee data theft scenario, where an employee uses a jump drive or uploads documents to the cloud or emails them to a personal account. This has been used in some federal courts, you know, to provide a civil cause of action for the employer. Some courts, particularly the Ninth Circuit, has been ratcheting down on the use of that particular statute. We're going to provide you some of the latest cases so that you can get a survey of what states across the country you can use that theory and which states you can't. Also, we're going to talk about there's been some developments about improving trade secret protection in the United States. It looks like Congress is poised to address federal legislation that would provide a federal civil cause of action for trade secret misappropriation. It just got out of the Senate Judiciary Committee with a markup, and we expect the Senate to address it sometime in the spring. We also want to provide a brief summary of what's going on in the EU, as well as the Trans-Pacific Agreement and how it impacts trade secret protection. The last two topics, we're going to deal with some key non-compete cases that have come up with in the last year. Primarily, these focus around consideration. And by that, I mean, if you're asking an existing employee to sign a restrictive covenant, what are those states that require you to provide something more than just continued employment? We saw some two key cases, one in Wisconsin and one in Pennsylvania, that came to different determinations. So we're going to discuss that and also highlight some additional significant non-compete cases. And then finally, Josh is going to get into one of our old friends, the NLRB, and what they've been doing with respect to really raining down on employers' agreements and policies, anything in those agreements or policies that could be construed to chill employees engaging in protected activities. We also saw some new entrants to that dialogue with the SEC coming down with some pronouncements about any sort of contract provisions that would chill employees from cooperating in government investigations. And that's significant because you need to make sure that your agreements and policies are not going to, you know, face the error of the NLRB or the SEC. So it's a good time to dust off those agreements and make sure that you're up to date with the latest developments there. So with that, I want to jump right into our first topic. There was a number of significant, noteworthy cases that came up in the past year. I mean, obviously on the data breach front, the Ashley Madison data breach was sort of front and center. Obviously, that's the website that encourages adultery amongst the participants, and their particular database were hacked, and the usernames and the user identity information of those particular users was put onto public websites, and it caused a lot of buzz and a lot of concern, particularly for those users. And I think it was an example of the type of personal information that people may disclose with third-party providers and internet companies, and how if that information is breached, how it could cause quite an embarrassment apart from any sort of financial harm that would come out of the data breach. We also saw an interesting case that highlights, at least for companies, the importance of making sure that passwords are changed when employees leave. And that was the Major League Baseball case involving a former employee of the Houston Astros, who had joined the St. Louis Cardinals and had been using a user's credentials to access the Astros database as it pertained to projected players and futures related to with respect to prospects. And I think the key takeaway there was that it's important for employers to make sure they have a handle on their password procedures. And, generally the rule of thumb is to make sure that, when an employee leaves, that those passwords are, that their access is cut off and that they can't use, their old credentials. But it probably goes more than that. I mean, it goes to contractors, vendors, suppliers that would also have access to your passwords and be able to access your system that when the vendor relationship or whatever relationship ends, to make sure that they still don't have access to your systems. In that particular case, there was a plea bargain, and the employee was charged with a violation of the Federal Computer Fraud and Abuse Act for hacking into the Astros computer network. Another significant case, we're seeing more activity with respect to the government cracking down on foreign nationals who may be taking trade secrets for foreign states, and that was the USA versus Wang. In that particular case, the defendant pleaded guilty to theft of trade secrets. The government valued the trade secrets at anywhere between $65 million to $150 million, and it was interesting in the plea agreement in which the government was laying out its case and justifying the conviction. There were some interesting facts about a document that the defendant had written. It was a document entitled Trip of Dream Realization, in which he described his scheming and planning to steal United States intellectual property. The defendant also stated in this dream realization, as the main thrust during China's development, it is necessary and obligatory for our generation to fulfill our share of responsibility in contributing towards the societal progress of China. And then he was arrested in May of 2015, and this particular plea bargain came in October of 2015. So again, a reminder that the government continues to show interest in pursuing trade secret claims against foreign nationals, particularly ones that are involved in that may be supporting foreign nation states. Another significant case this past year that finally got wrapped up is the case that had been going on for a number of years, and that was the Kolon Industries case that was brought by DuPont, and it involved DuPont's Kevlar technology. Now, that's the technology that is used in body armor. A lot of law enforcement and military officials purchased the DuPont body armor, and that's essentially what the case focused on as far as some employees that were recruited to join Kolon Industries and the allegations of massive trade secret misappropriation and data theft related to that case. The case, it progressed over the years, and it actually resulted in nearly $1 billion civil judgment against Kolon, which was appealed. And as part of the resolution of that case, the close $1 billion jury verdict was overturned. But Kolon did agree to pay $275 million in restitution, and they were fined $85 million in criminal fines, and they pled guilty. There was a companion criminal case, which really brought the party's dispute to a head, and was able to provide DuPont with a fairly significant monetary result, as well as, obviously to set back their competitor, Kolon Industries, for a number of years. Another case that we've been following that's somewhat significant is the Alenikoff case, and that was a former employee who left his employer and went to start a new company, and the technology involved was source code for high-speed stock trading, a case out of Illinois. And he was convicted in federal court under the Economic Espionage Act. That particular conviction was overturned. Subsequently, in 2014 and 15, he was tried by the New York Attorney General for a violation of that state's penal code related to computer crimes. He was convicted under that statute, but the judge threw out the conviction under the New York Penal Code. And part of the judge's reasoning is that Alenikoff hadn't made any tangible reproductions of the code. And the key issue there was that he had sent a digital copy of the source code to a foreign server. And so I think the significance of that case is that sometimes the laws that are on the books are somewhat antiquated and don't deal with the electronic information age that we live in, particularly both of the convictions being overturned. At least in the case of the Economic Espionage Act, it was subsequently amended to deal specifically with that case. And it'll be interesting to see if the New York legislature similarly changes their computer theft statute to deal with the electronic theft of proprietary information. And then lastly, one case that recently hit the news, some former GlaxoSmithKline scientists were charged with a vast conspiracy to steal the company's cancer research secrets. There was a FBI press release with respect to this this case. I think there's some key takeaways that we can learn about these developments and cases over the years. One thing I should highlight is on the data breach side, typically companies that are facing civil class actions, consumer class actions having to deal with data breach along the lines of the Ashley Madison or other retailers that have been in the news for data breaches, oftentimes those plaintiffs face a very difficult path in order to pursue claims against the companies. And that's primarily because there's a well-established standing doctrine in the courts, particularly in the federal courts, that has, effectively to date, kind of kept the courts outside of the reach of the plaintiff's bar in pursuing these cases because there's been a finding that there's not standing, that these particular consumers haven't faced suffered an injury in fact. We saw a development in that area this year with the Neiman Marcus case out of the Seventh Circuit. And in this particular case, it was sort of a game changer, and it opened up a stronger minority view that, in fact, you could have standing. The class of plaintiffs that were involved contained persons who had actually experienced fraudulent charges on their accounts. And the court found that there was sufficient standing for those individuals. Particularly, there was identifiable cost associated with the process of sorting things out, and there was a substantial risk of future harm, at least according to this the Seventh Circuit Court. So we expect and predict that there's going to be continuing development where more and more courts may be willing to adopt the rationale of the Neiman Marcus group case and find that in your typical scenario where there's been a data breach and personal identifiable information has been taken and potentially disclosed, that the plaintiff's bar may have a much easier time to bring a consumer class action. Typically, those cases in the past have been met with motion to dismiss on standing grounds, and courts have routinely granted those motion to dismiss, but we see a lot more activity in the next couple of years, we expect, on those cases. There was a recent study that we wanted to highlight for you about the cost of data breach. It was a recent Poneman IBM study in 2015. It was a nice representative sample of over 350 companies that participated in this data breach study. And what they saw is that the total cost of data breach had actually increased over the past 2 years. There was a 23% increase in the total average cost of a data breach. And so it went to, they actually provided some specifics with respect to the average cost paid for each lost stolen record containing sensitive and confidential information. And it jumped from $145 in 2014 to $154 in 2015. The retail industry was particularly impacted, and their average cost of dealing with a data breach moved from $105 for each lost or stolen record up to $165. So the cost of companies having to deal with data breach is growing at an alarming rate. And so, what are some of the lessons learned this past year in this area? I think number one, it's not a matter of when, it's not a matter of if your company is going to be compromised and perhaps there's going to be a data breach. It's a matter of when, not if. So that's why it makes it very important for companies to have information security policies and a data breach response plan. Particularly publicly traded companies, that is what the SEC is expecting that companies have, and that their board makes sure that companies have adequate security policies in place and a data breach response plan. And as part of that data breach response plan, companies are being expected to actually execute on that plan and do various drills to do basically test episodes so that they can stress test their systems against data breaches. One thing that we found, and this is documented by the study, is with respect to the theft of trade secrets as well as data breach, Employee education is at the paramount thing that companies really need to improve their practices on. We're seeing more and more companies go to employee training and education as it relates to protecting trade secrets and protecting against data breach. Many companies are going to an e-learning type model. That's something that Cyfarth is now offering as far as e-learning on data security protection. And essentially, in a nutshell, what that is providing, you know, a nice overview to employees about how they can play their role in not exposing the company's systems and networks to phishing campaigns, you know, those suspicious emails that you get in your email box, as well as when they go on company travel and how they store their computer devices and what type of Wi-Fi access they obtain. We're also seeing, as far as lesson learned on the data breach area, is that companies that are facing this litigation are much more successful if they've employed arbitration agreements with class action waivers. In light of the AT&T Concepcion case, courts are more and more receptive to compel arbitration and to honor class action waivers. And so if you're a company that's facing a data breach class action or any sort of consumer class action, and that, for that regard, if you have an enforceable arbitration agreement with a class action waiver, you're in a much more powerful position in having to deal with that particular lawsuit. That is because, obviously, that the if you're able to compel arbitration, then you're dealing with a single arbitration as opposed to a class arbitration, and it's much more manageable in resolving the issue. And the plaintiff's bar is not interested in typically bringing one particular arbitration claim against one company. The money really is in the class action. Another lesson learned that we're finding is that companies need to be vigilant in protecting their most important assets and involve law enforcement as needed, as evidenced by the U.S. versus Wang case and the DuPont case. There are times when companies need to reach out to law enforcement to get involved in trade secret cases, and it can lead to good results for those companies. But the key thing to keep in mind is that once you get the feds involved and the government involved in your trade secret investigation, companies do lose a substantial amount of control in the investigation, and they can't always decide when they want to resolve the matter. It's really taken out of your control. I think our last lesson learned is that the limitations in the law, particularly in international misappropriation cases, that's one of the key issues that was in the Colon case, because Colon is obviously based in Korea, and there were some challenges that were reflected in that case about obtaining service of process over a foreign company. Same thing with respect to trade secret cases involving Chinese nationals. And companies involved in China that are accused of trade secret or misappropriation by U.S. companies. Companies are continuing to face that issue as far as how do they obtain jurisdiction over those companies and over those individuals. There was a big press release, I think, earlier in the year about the U.S. government was indicting some members of the Chinese military over their hacking of some manufacturing companies in Pennsylvania, which made for a nice press release, but as far as any reasonable chance of ever obtaining any sort of conviction over those individuals, it's remote. So that continues to be a concern about how to deal with data theft, trade secret misappropriation that occurs abroad. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Joshua Salinas, who's going to get into some of the new trade secret cases that came up within the last year that we think are significant from a national perspective and that you might want to know about.
Thanks, Robert. Some of these new trade secret cases are important, especially for businesses who are conducting business in these jurisdictions or have employees in these jurisdictions. But there are also some lessons learned for companies in general who may not be in these specific jurisdictions. The first case, Innosys versus Mercer, this was a decision from the Utah Supreme Court, and that court found that trade secret misappropriation under the Uniform Trade Secret Act gives rise to a rebuttable presumption of irreparable harm the Supreme Court reversed a trial court decision that had granted summary judgment in favor of the defendant. The dispute involved a defense industry technology company, and they had a dispute with their former engineer who they alleged had copied a whole bunch of confidential information, had forwarded confidential emails to her personal Gmail account, had copied a confidential business plan to an external hard drive. And the company brought claims, including trade secret misappropriation. And one of the issues was that at the hearing, the former employee had allegedly deleted and destroyed and these files and documents. And the court, based on that, found that there was no actual or threatened harm to the plaintiff because these documents essentially were no longer in her control or possession. The Utah Supreme Court reversed and found that, you know, it's pretty predominant and it's well established under the UTSA that there is a presumption of irreparable harm, albeit it is rebuttable for the misappropriation of trade secrets. And kind of the lessons to be learned is, you know, obviously you want to prevent employees and former employees from misappropriating and taking any data, but it's also key these kind of computer forensic issues when you are seeking to reacquire or return any data that may have been improperly taken. And so it's key, especially when you're coordinating the return of company information, to not simply ask employees to delete all data, but there may be issues where that electronic data may have some additional data or metadata showing that the employee may have transferred it to other devices, printed it, or may have sent it to other third parties. So while the court did find that even though the employee had destroyed the data, there was no, that there was still some irreparable harm, it's not going to be something to completely rely on. And you know, hopefully you don't want any of that data destroyed in the first place. The next case is Williams-Sonoma Direct versus Arhaus. It involved a dispute between two companies who were in the home retail goods industry, and also a former employee who had left to join a competitor. It was a case that the plaintiff brought in a motion for injunctive relief seeking to prevent that employee who had just left from further soliciting any individuals, but also there were some concerns with trade secret misappropriation, and the plaintiff asked for injunctive relief to actually prevent that former employee from working for the new competitor. The court did grant limited injunctive relief, finding that the competitor and the departing employee could not use any company trade secrets, could not use or disclose those trade secrets, and also could not solicit any individuals. But the one thing that the court was reluctant to issue was injunctive relief preventing that former employee from completely working for that new company. The court found that this restraint was just too severe and too harm. It rejected the plaintiff's argument of inevitable disclosure, meaning that the former employee just knew such critical confidential information that it was inevitable he would eventually disclose it for his new company. But we've seen this with some courts who have been reluctant to give overly broad injunctive relief. This court specifically noted that it was just too severe, too substantial of a burden on the former employee to completely deprive him of his ability to work or any income. And so the court did allow him to work for the new company, but did have some limited restrictions for injunctive relief. So one thing to learn is even in cases where the facts may appear to be overwhelmingly favorable, courts are still going to consider the burden and potential harm to the other side, including in cases with employee mobility. Obviously, it'll depend on the jurisdictions and the facts of each case. An additional case, it was a Sixth Circuit case, Orthofix versus Hunter, and it involved a holding where the court found that confidential information could be protected under a non-disclosure agreement regardless if the information is trade secret or not. Now, there are some jurisdictions which find that if information is taken, if it's mere confidential information and it does not rise to the level of a trade secret, it may not be protected. And so it was notable in this case. It involved a Orthofix had brought on the defendant as he was a salesman for a bone growth product. And as part of his employment, they gave him essentially what was a company playbook. Had all the confidential information regarding business practices, customer information, sales data, pricing. And when he did leave, there were allegations that some trade secret and confidential information was taken. And the key issue in this case, the court looked at the definition of confidential information and found that the data that was taken did violate the non-disclosure provision, but specifically found that the confidential information, even if it did not rise to the level of trade secret, was protected by this non-disclosure agreement. And specifically, the court noted that there were specific characterizations or definitions highlighting that this information included business strategies, business practices, customer information, sales methods. And so some of the lessons to be learned, while there are some jurisdictions may find that mere confidential information may or may not be protected if it's not a trade secret, there are some good practices for preparing non-disclosure agreements, including to some extent providing more details of what that confidential information it is and if it can be described or identified in better detail. But it's also important to note that companies cannot completely rely on non-disclosure agreements in these circumstances. You do want to employ effective policies and practices to prevent and protect trade secret and also confidential or proprietary information. It includes also employee education, but also ensuring the return of all company data, whether it is confidential or not, when employees leave. And one recommendation would include putting return of property provisions in employee agreements and also conducting exit interviews. Just a few more additional new trade secret cases to go over. The Spear Marketing versus Bancorp South case, it's a Fifth Circuit case regarding copyright preemption. It joined the majority circuit split and found that trade secrets within software would, within copyrightable subject matter, are subject to preemption. In this case, which is somewhat of a familiar scenario, Spear Marketing had met with another competitor company to do a joint project to develop a kind of joint venture. A dispute later arose, and the plaintiff argued that some of the information, confidential information that it disclosed, specifically some of the elements of its software design, had allegedly been taken. And so it brought a complaint for, among other things, trade secret misappropriation, conversion, and some other state law claims. The defendant in this case, since the case was originally brought in state court, removed the case to federal court based on copyright preemption, and the court found that this trade secret information, because it was in this fixed medium, was subject to copyright preemption. And so this case is notable because sometimes defendants, if you are in state court and want to get to federal court based on maybe the federal judge or federal bench has more experience with these IP cases, or certain federal jurisdictions are more favorable to the defense, or may analyze or review claims more in depth. It is a consideration that you may be able to use a copyright preemption to get your case in a federal court if you don't have another method of getting there. The CDM Media case versus Sims is a case we've been, which discusses social media, to what extent social media assets can be protectable as trade secrets. There has been numerous cases every year that discuss to the extent your friends, your contacts, the content in your Facebook, LinkedIn, MySpace accounts can be protectable. There is a somewhat inherent conflict where social media is generally, to be public and shared, and so a lot of that information may not be protected because it is public. In this case, it involved an employee who left, but during his employment, he created a Facebook or a LinkedIn group that had about 600 to 700 customers, as well as I think it had taken 4 years to develop this information and gather and aggregate everything. The company wanted to gain possession and access to that, so they take control of that group. The court found that, at least at the early stages, at the pleading stages, it could not determine whether or not the LinkedIn group membership list could be a trade secret. It was simply too early. It was a question of fact, and so there was still, it was unknown to what extent it was protected or could be protectable. There were some allegations that there were some privacy settings that would restrict it and make it not public, but the court simply said that it may constitute a trade secret, but at this point in time, it could not determine, and so it was better a question of fact left for later resolution. The court did note that the communications within that LinkedIn group likely were not going to be protected as trade secrets. There may be certain messages that could be protected, but as a general, the communications that the plaintiff has sought protection over may not constitute trade secrets. And then lastly, there was a Texas Supreme Court that upheld there was a multi-million-dollar jury verdict for this misappropriation of the seismic, essentially the treasure map in the gas drilling dispute, as the parties referred to it. The underlying case was interesting because it involved a dispute where there was alleged misappropriation of these maps that were used to identify and detect these prospective drilling areas. The defense in that case had argued that these maps were shared with prospective investors, they were shared with customers, they were shared with third parties, and were not shared under the protection of a non-disclosure agreement or a confidentiality agreement. And so the argument was that, you know, because this information had been disclosed, they were no longer protected as trade secrets. The underlying courts, and including the appellate court, found that that did not necessarily remove any protection of trade secret status, that even though there was no confidentiality agreement, the information could still be protected. It's even if there wasn't that NDA, it's kind of a unique and rare case. We've seen a lot of cases that have found that if there is no non-disclosure agreement or confidentiality agreement, that sometimes is dispositive of whether the information can be protectable. But at least it shows that there's this Texas court has shown a willingness to protect certain information that is disclosed in these sometimes secret or private scenarios. And then I'll go quickly through. There continues to be a split in the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. Circuits, including the 2nd, 9th, and 4th Circuit, have taken a narrow approach regarding the definition of authorization or exceeds authorized access. There continues to be this circuit split, and even there's a U.S. Assistant U.S. Attorney who asked Congress this past year that, you know, the CFA needs to be amended to actually clarify whether the narrower or broader views were intended. And so some of the more narrow interpretations of the CFAA, the recent cases, the Christensen and the Valle case, were noteworthy following kind of the seminal case, Nozal. What Nozal found was that under the CFAA, it's more akin to an anti-hacking statute, and so the mere breach of employer computer use agreements or computer policies may not constitute a violation of the statute. And so if an employee does have access to a database, regardless of what they use, if they misuse that information, it may not be a violation. The Christensen and Valle case both involve similar scenarios where employees had access to employer databases. And while they did maybe violate some computer use policies, the courts found that there was no actual exceeding authorization. And so they found that there was no violation and overturned those convictions. Similar that happened in the Giles Construction case, that the court followed the Ninth Circuit and found that a breach of a corporate guidelines agreement did not constitute a violation of the CFAA. And similar with the enhanced recovery case. These cases are noteworthy because they have provided challenges for companies in those jurisdictions who may want to bring claims against former employees who maybe have misused that information. There are some additional cases that we're still waiting to hear further opinions from. the Nassau case, while there was a Ninth Circuit decision previously, there's a new decision that's expected this upcoming year regarding whether password sharing could constitute a violation of the statute. And in that case, there was a former employee who, while he had left the company, asked current employees to access information for him. And oral arguments were heard a few months ago, and so we should hear a decision soon regarding further explanations regarding that kind of narrow approach. Similar with Facebook Ventures, there's a further decision expected regarding kind of circumventing technological measures. In that case, Power Ventures was a third party that created this web app that consolidated essentially users' social media information from Facebook and other sites into kind of a single consolidated interface. Facebook alleged that this kind of third party tool had violated their terms of use. I believe Facebook had even set up some IP blocking mechanisms that Power Ventures was still able to circumvent. Nonetheless, Power Ventures recently argued at oral argument about a month ago that authorization under the CFAA concerns data ownership, and that data that was copied from Facebook's site was actually disclaimed allegedly by Facebook. So we should expect a decision on that soon. And then just kind of on the other side of the broad interpretation of the CFAA, there was a Eastern District of Michigan case in American Furukawa versus Hussein, who actually criticized Nassau and found that it was that there should be protections for violating the statute, even if there is a violation of computer use policies, and found that the Sixth Circuit should likely rule. At least with the CFAA, the Supreme Court has not ruled, and so we'll continue to see this circuit split until there is an additional ruling. Kind of going back to the Christensen case, while it did follow the Ninth Circuit narrow interpretation in Nassau, it did issue a really key decision regarding distinguishing California Penal Code 502, which is California's computer fraud statute, from the CFAA, and actually found that California statute language has language built in regarding the misuse of data. And so it found that an employee who does access a database or system, even if they have access but later take or misuse that data, they actually could be liable for violation of the California Penal Code statute. So that is important. It's noteworthy because it gives employers a civil cause of action under California, which they may not otherwise have under Nassau and the CFAA.
Thanks, Josh. One significant development that we saw this year was progress on the Defend Trade Secrets Act. That's the movement at the U.S. Congress to provide a civil cause of action for trade secret misappropriation in federal court. Right now, trade secret misappropriation is primarily a creature of state court. The only way you can really get into federal court is if you have diversity jurisdiction. And there's a number of sponsors for this legislation. I think as of what we last looked, there was over 107 sponsors for the Defend Trade Secrets Act in the House, as well as over 25 sponsors in the Senate. As I indicated earlier, the Senate Judiciary Committee recently, as of yesterday, actually marked up the legislation, and we expect that there may be a vote on the Senate floor sometime in the spring. Essentially, some of the significant differences between the Federal Trade Secret Act and the Uniform Trade Secret Act that's been adopted by at least 48 states in the United States is that there's an ex parte seizure order. So that would allow a plaintiff to have the alleged trade secret goods to be seized by a law enforcement official and provided to the court pending a ruling on the plaintiff's injunction application. And so that's somewhat significant. It ties into trying to keep trade secrets from leaving the borders of the United States. Imagine a scenario where you know that someone's about ready to leave and hop on a plane to go to a foreign country, and you need to rush into court to prevent that, as well as to get the misappropriated goods from being transferred or evidence of misappropriation from being destroyed. And so that's, I think, part of the thought process with respect to the ex parte seizure order. We've been tracking this legislation on our trade secret blog. So if you're interested in the latest and greatest, we did a blog post yesterday that lays out what the differences are after the Senate markup of the bill. It looks like there is momentum for this, so we could be having a federal civil cause of action before the end of the year. The other thing that we're seeing is other parts of the world are trying to enhance their trade secret protections as well. In Europe, there's a proposed EU directive, and essentially what that would provide would be a uniform standard in those countries that are part of the EU for protecting trade secrets. And it looks like there's also, similar to the United States, that there's momentum for passing this directive. Currently, there's only a patchwork of trade secret protections across the EU. It really depends. The trade secret laws in Italy compared to those that are in Germany and other parts of the EU, they can vary dramatically, particularly with respect to damages and the ability to get injunctive relief. So the idea is for companies, particularly companies with strong research and development departments, to have sort of uniform baseline standards so that they can know that if they go into a particular country, if they set up a plant there, that their information will be protected if there's a worst case scenario. Now, there's been this directive has been moving swiftly recently. A provisional agreement was reached in December of 2015, and the Legal Affairs Committee approved the provisional rules on January 28th. And Parliament is expected to vote on the directive around March of 2016. So we could be seeing legislation protecting trade secrets, not only in the United States, but in Europe this year. Another significant development is the Trans-Pacific Partnership. This involves 12 Pacific Rim countries, significantly Australia, Canada, Mexico, the United States. And what it does is similar to the EU directive. It's trying to ensure that there's a minimum base standard to protect trade secrets in various countries. And so the upshot of this particular partnership as it relates to trade secrets is that it would require countries such as Australia, Canada, Singapore, and Malaysia, who are a part of that partnership, to implement criminal procedures and penalties for the unauthorized misappropriation of trade secrets. Currently, there's not statutes specifically on the book that criminalize trade secret misappropriation in those countries. So this could be, again, another good development for those companies that may want to invest in these particular countries so that they know that they have minimum base standards to protect their trade secrets if they were to be misappropriated. Now, this particular partnership needs to be approved by the U.S. Congress as well as the other 11 Pacific Rim countries before it goes into effect. With that, I want to turn it over to Jesse Coleman to give us an update on some of the most significant non-compete cases that have come out within the last year.
Excuse me, good morning or good afternoon, wherever you are in your jurisdictions and time frames. I'm coming to you from sunny Houston here. I mentioned that because of the topic of what we're going to discuss here today is non-competes. And unlike trade secret matters, which have a bit of a uniformity across jurisdictions, most jurisdictions have adopted the Uniform Trade Secrets Act in some form or another. And as Robert has mentioned, we're looking at potentially a federal cause of action in that non-compete actions and laws are dispersed and diverse throughout the country. Nonetheless, we can see some trends and we can see some significant decisions is what I'm hoping to go over here today. So starting maybe perhaps on one end of the spectrum, we've got what can be called a new golden rule in California. In the Golden versus California Emergency Physical Medical case, a Ninth Circuit determining a California question of law has determined that a no rehire provision in a settlement agreement could, under certain circumstances, constitute an unlawful restraint of trade under California law. This no rehire came up in the context of a settlement agreement. Dr. Golden, who was a physician, agreed to settle his discrimination claim against his employer, California Emergency Physicians Medical Group. And in that agreement, Dr. Goldman had to waive any rights to employment with CEP or any facility that they may own in the future. Dr. Golden later argued that the no rehire clause was unlawful because it constituted a material term of the settlement and that the entire agreement was void. Ninth Circuit ultimately determined that Dr. Golden might prevail on this argument, and as it pertains to the validity of the no rehire clause, the Ninth Circuit took a wider view of what is traditionally understood with regards to no rehire clauses in California, determining that no rehire clauses could not apply even to the entity in which you were a former member of, a former employee of, under California law, the particular provision being that a contract is void if it restrains anyone from engaging in a lawful profession. The Ninth Circuit determined that that unlawful profession could even be the one that you're leaving. So Golden ultimately in this matter, it doesn't furnish any clear guidance as to the continued viability of no rehire clauses in California, but it does raise the specter that no rehire clauses can be construed very broadly, and the key takeaway for employers and in-house counsel on this topic is to be aware if in fact your jurisdiction maintains a no rehire clause. Going in the other direction, we've seen a number of cases across the country where restrictive covenants in franchise agreements have been enforced by the franchisor against both the franchisees and persons who benefit but are not signatories to the agreement. So, for example, in the Eastern District of Wisconsin, Everett versus Paul Davis, Wisconsin federal judge held that an individual who was not a signatory to a franchise agreement that included a confidentiality clause was bound by that, not because he was signatory, but because he benefited from the franchise, and so therefore was prohibited from using the franchisor's trade secrets. In another case, HH Franchising, an Ohio federal judge ordered an ex-franchisee that had signed an agreement to return the franchisor its operations manual and other materials relating to the franchise agreement. Moving along, because we're running short here on time, I'm going to briefly glide over some of these other issues. We've seen a number of cases also where the courts have declined to issue the injunctive relief that has been requested, even with the allegations of a violation of the non-compete, because the employers that are seeking to enforce the non-competes had failed in other respects, for example, to show an immediate risk, an imminent risk of immediate harm, which is an element for injunctive relief in many jurisdictions. Takeaway from this, I think, is that violations of non-compete are not a sure bet for injunctive relief. It's important in the agreements, for example, to make sure that there is language that's included that shows that this is that the violation of the non-compete, as it is attached to consideration for confidentiality and trade secrets, for example, making it otherwise ancillary to an enforceable agreement, that's spelled out in the actual agreement to make it enforceable and to increase the chances that a court will find irreparable harm. It's not a sure bet. Speaking of consideration, we've seen a number of cases in the past year that courts have struggled with the idea of adequacy of consideration. We've seen them coming down in different directions. Illinois, as many of you know, at this point has some competing decisions on this issue. For example, the Fifield Court determined essentially that continued employment for any period short of 2 years does not constitute sufficient consideration for a non-compete, which very clearly left open the idea that if the employment relationship lasts at least 2 years beyond the date of execution, that could be, in fact, consideration for a non-compete and therefore make it enforceable. However, a panel more recently of the Illinois Appellate Court split 2-1 on whether Fifield should, in fact, be followed, and there's been a number of other Chicago federal trial judges who have adjudicated cases and had to decide whether it was necessary to predict whether the Illinois Supreme Court would agree with that, and they've come to opposing conclusions. On the far end of the spectrum, we have Pennsylvania that has ruled that that continued employment or any change in employment status was not enough consideration, and that a non-compete had lack of consideration under those circumstances. On the other hand, we have the Supreme Court of Wisconsin coming down with a determination that continued employment is in fact sufficient consideration for the enforcement of a non-compete clause. Going to choice of law, many companies choose to go to Delaware to incorporate. It's a business-friendly environment, and there's often choice of law provisions that focus on allowing for Delaware to be the venue and the forum and the choice of law. And recently, however, there's been at least one case that, despite the fact that employment agreement had a Delaware choice of law and venue provision contained in the agreement, the court determined in the Chancery Court, in an unpublished opinion, determined that California law applied to the agreement. Some of the reasoning in that is that while the company Ascension was incorporated in Delaware, it was headquartered in California, which is also where the employee worked. So while there's clearly value to having a single state law governing its relationships, and Delaware law is comparatively employee-friendly, cases like this demonstrate that there's a risk that home states will still control, even in Delaware courts. And the takeaway here is that one needs to be wary of that moving forward in this type of litigation. So I will turn the time back over here in the time we have left to Rob and Josh to address some new state non-compete legislation.
All right, thanks. We're going to announce the CLE code for those who've been patiently waiting. It's SS, as in Seyfarth Shaw, 6196. That's SS, as in Seyfarth Shaw, 6196. Just to briefly wrap up or to go over some of the new states that have social or non-compete legislation, I'll just highlight a few of them. Hawaii did, in an effort to kind of stimulate their economy, did issue a ban that against non-competes or non-solicits for non-competes in employees who are in the technology business. These specific non-competes are void, but in other industries outside of technology, they can be enforceable to the extent they are reasonable under Hawaii's laws. New Mexico did have a ban on non-competes for healthcare practitioners, but one thing to note is it does not prevent any confidentiality agreements, trade secret agreements, or non-solicit disclosure agreements. And then with Alabama, it did revise a statute to make it easier to enforce non-competes in Alabama. It identified six specific exceptions of contracts that would be enforceable, and also identified six types of protectable interests that could be used to enforce non-competes, including trade secrets, customer relationships, and goodwill. Regarding next, there has been some federal legislation to get non-competes. This specifically concerned low-wage employees. I believe it was for employees who were making under $15 an hour. It didn't get much traction and had only a few sponsors, but we note that it could be inspirational for state reforms. We do have a 50-state survey that we'll provide at the end with our materials. And when we circulate them, covers the different states, non-competes, some of their limitations and restrictions, and it's a helpful, easy-to-use guide. Three states have been following or joined the other states that have implemented some type of social media privacy policies. Right now, there's about a little over 20 states that have some type of statute protecting whether employers can ask employees for access to personal social media accounts and what they can do. The consequences vary from state to state of you know, whether there's penalties or whether there's different relief that can be provided. Again, we do have a easy to use desktop reference that we update every year that will also circulate identifying the different states' social media policies. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Jesse.
Hey, thank you, Josh. It's 1 o'clock, so I understand, folks, if you all want to head out. I am going to go briefly through this information if you want to stick around to hear about some of these cases. I'll go very quickly. And, of course, we've got this information. You're more than welcome to reach out to us. I'm going to point to a document here at the end of our presentation that contains all of this material in greater detail that you can review and that's available for you. But for now, I'm going to go over very briefly the a number of government agencies, including the SEC and the NLRB, that are scrutinizing employer policies and agreements, and particularly with regards to whistleblower complaints and complaints and concerted action and discussions regarding employee matters. So one of the most significant decisions of the 2015 year is the cease and desist order penalizing KBR for confidentiality statements that failed to carve out protected federal whistleblower complaints. In the statement, when there was an internal investigation, they required their employees to sign an agreement that said essentially, I'm prohibited from discussing any particulars without prior authorization from my law department. The Securities and Exchange Commission found that this violated SEC Rule 21F17, which states that no person may take any action to impede an individual from communicating directly with the commission staff about possible securities law violation. KBR was ultimately fined $130,000 and was required to add new language, essentially carving out the ability to communicate with SEC and to the effect that nothing in the confidentiality statement prohibits me, the signatory, from reporting possible violations of federal law and so forth and so on. In a subsequent discussion with the ABA, the SEC Office of Whistleblower Chief Sean McKessie has stated that he views the SEC Rule 21F17 as very broad and intentionally so, and that ultimately he reads the rule stating that no person shall take any action to impede an individual from communicating with directly with the SEC. Moving on to NLRB, National Labor Relations Board, there has been some interesting actions on this front. The NLRB has issued recently a memorandum from the General Counsel stating what employer rules can or cannot do, and some of the major points here I have on the slide. They cannot have blanket rules on discussing employee information. They can only require the employees to be respectful. They prohibit. Anyway, I'll go ahead and let you read that for the interest of time. Jumping back. An employee is protected under the National Labor Relations Act when engaging in discussion of work conditions, even on social media. And the case that we're going to look at very briefly actually involves social media and Facebook and likes. Before we get to that case, there is this employee agreement that the NLRB actually found did not violate the act. And you can read it here. It says, you know, while your free time is generally not subject to any restriction, company urges all employees not to post information. This can, you know, be accomplished by always thinking before you post. Interestingly, in this case, the ALJ determined that if the first sentence had been left by itself, that could violate the NLRA. But if you add the second sentence, the qualifying language, onto it, that saves it. This is the Landry's case number 32CA118213. Getting to the Facebook case, we have a sports bar employee that criticized the employer on Facebook, and other employees liked what they had said there. And there have been other statements a little bit even more colorful. And then when Triple Play had discovered that its employees had participated in this discussion, it terminated their employment. Ultimately, the Second Circuit affirmed the NLRB decision that this constituted concerted activities protected by Section 7. So the takeaway from this is that employers must obviously tread lightly before disciplining employees for social media comments that might appear to be critical of their employees, and they should review their social media policies to make sure they're not in violation of the act. As I had mentioned before, we have a year in review, a several hundred page document here that's hyperlinked and easy to run through. It's got a great table of contents, and we would encourage you to take a look at that when you have an opportunity. And I'll pass the time back over to Rob and Josh for a wrap up.
Thanks, Jesse. So thank you very much for sitting in on today's webinar. We're going to have some good webinar content this year. Our next program is going to be on how to prevent data theft. That's going to be a webinar available in February. If you're interested in signing up, please be sure to go on our trade secret blog, www.tradesecretslaw.com. Also, we're going to have a webinar in March about the Defend Trade Secrets Act. We did have a few questions, and so we'll briefly go over those questions. We obviously understand if you need to leave. Before we get into the two questions that we did receive, I'd like to give you the CLE code again. It's SS6196. One of the questions came up with respect to independent contractors, particularly independent contractors in entertainment and fitness. And the question is, how do you protect your trade secret with respect to those contractors compared to employees? And I think, you know, you do have some limits on the type of restrictive covenants that you can use with independent contractors. You know, certainly that cuts against the lack of control that is necessary to demonstrate independent contractor. But certainly you would use non-disclosure covenants, and to the extent that you're providing them with your company information, your property, so that they can do their job, you need to bake that into your contract, non-disclosure covenants and returning company materials as part of their assignment. And then most importantly, make sure you get your information back. So in a lot of times in a company's life cycle on a project, they may have employees and contractors all touch that key level project, and they may have great agreements and policies in place with their employees, but they don't necessarily have those same protections in place with their contractors. So you need to make sure that the contractors sign NDAs. And if you're executing a more sort of global agreement with the contract provider, and you're not having individual agreements with the employees of the contractor, you need to have something in your contract that makes it clear that the independent contractor is expected to have non-disclosure agreements with their employees, and so that they understand that if they're working on your project, that they're going to keep that information confidential. Also, a question, Josh. Somebody wanted to know, you know, what's the difference between the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and this Penal Code 502, and what's the real takeaway for employers in California?
The real takeaway is you now have employers in California who have a cause of action, a civil cause of action they can bring for the theft and misuse of their data. Before, under NASAL, it was limited, and an employee may have had access to information but later misused it. It may not be actionable under the CFAA, but now under the Penal Code 502, that if an employee does have access and then without permission either misuses or takes that information, they could be liable.
Great. Thanks, Josh. And thanks again to the audience for participating. We look forward to talking with you again for our next webinar. Have a great day.
This concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending.